All right, so by way of background or recap, if you haven't been here every week or been a part of the series, you're just jumping in. We're almost halfway through. Chapter 5 is technically halfway, so I thought I'd do a short recap of where we're at, how we got to this point. So the book of Esther is set in this time where the Jewish people are in exile in Persia under the rule of Ahasuerus. And in the first chapter, we see the king threw a party. It was quite the rager. Apparently on day 7, he had too much to drink. And he requests his queen at the time, Vashti, to come before the party to kind of show her off. Vashti refuses and is removed as queen by edict from the king. And so Ahasuerus' people and himself have this brilliant idea that he's going to have all the beautiful young virgins compelled into the king's service, brought into the royal palace and into the royal harem so that he can choose another queen. And in this group of virgins, Esther, who is a Jewish exile, she's brought in as part of this kind of sweep of all the beautiful virgins. And she keeps her Jewish identity hidden by suggestion of her uncle Mordecai, who's taken the place as her father. And so through the process, I'll do the short version with the kids in the room, Esther wins the queen's favor and is made queen. And Mordecai discovers and reports a plot against the king right after this happens. And throughout the time of in the court, a guy named Haman is then promoted within the kingdom. And Mordecai, the same guy that has discovered this plot and helped save the king, refuses to pay homage to Haman at the city gate. And so Haman hatches a plot to basically perform a state-sanctioned genocide of all the Jewish people based off of his frustration and grudge against Mordecai. And goes to the king, they cast lots, they call it Pur, and they figure out the right time. They go before the king and they get the king to actually agree to this. And so that kind of brings us right up to chapter 4. The king's made this decree on such and such a date, all the Jews and all the kingdom are going to be eradicated, and all the people of the kingdom can just take their stuff. Not a good time to be Jewish in this kingdom. And so that brings us to our text today. It says, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting. And many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Mordecai responds the same way all of his ancestors would have. When they were facing a dire situation, devastating situation, they would take on this posture of mourning. They would tear their clothes, they'd put on sackcloth, they'd cover themselves in ashes. And the Jewish people among the kingdom joined with Mordecai as they express this distress as they're doing it. And as we mentioned, as you see, we call this series Tracing the Fingerprints of God. So as we talk, I'm going to point out little areas where we might see God being alluded to or pointed at without being explicit. And so this is one of those points. The Jewish people, when they face these situations, they would go break out into mourning, and that was typically to plead with God for salvation. So the Jewish people, though they're in exile, they're not in their homeland, they're not in the promised land of Israel, they decide to go back to the way that they've learned, and that's to go into mourning and plead to God. And it's an interesting decision just tactically. There's been an edict that just came out that said everyone who's Jewish is going to be eradicated on this date. And the Jewish people's response is interesting, Mordecai especially. Mordecai goes right into the center of the city, of the capital. I mean, right outside the gate of the palace. So, I mean, picture you're at the White House, on the front lawn of the White House, doing this. And decides to go into mourning, identifying himself as a Jew. My brain tactically goes, bad idea. It's an interesting decision that Mordecai makes. He's gotten to a point where he's not going to hide his Jewishness at this point. He understands that things are in trouble and they need to cry out to God and not be worried about the kind of cultural implications of them identifying themselves as Jewish people. Mordecai especially has a strong reaction to this because ultimately, Mordecai's actions here are what triggered this response. Now, what Mordecai did was not necessarily evil in the sight of God, but his refusal to acknowledge Haman is what started the grudge that led Haman to hatch this plan. So try to imagine being Mordecai at this point. You're suddenly realizing that your actions have led to a state-sanctioned genocide of your entire people after you've been captured and brought into exile. And you're at the city gates, you're at the palace gates in mourning, crying out, hoping for deliverance, hoping for relief. Now, this isn't necessarily the main point of the passage, but it's something I think is worth pointing out here for us as the people of God. We tend to think of our faith really individualistically, that what we do, our actions affect us. And I think this is an example, along with many other that you would find in the Old Testament and in the Scripture in general, of your actions ripple out beyond just you. They affect the people of God. A sinful action by one of us can result in consequences for all of us. We can see that today, modern times, with maybe public figures who are Christians who've had moral failings and things like that. And think about how that's affected your conversations about Jesus with people that don't believe in Jesus but know about this. On the flip side, it also does show that righteous actions have positive consequences for all of us. As we as a family here at Roosevelt pursue righteousness, pursue justice, we are going to benefit from the blessings that come from seeing that. So again, not the primary point, but something worth, I think, pointing out here, that Mordecai's come to this point of realizing his actions have caused this to happen. He no longer is worried about hiding, and the Jewish people join with him in mourning. And so as they're lamenting this coming Holocaust, and Mordecai is making this scene outside the palace, word gets to Esther. Gets back to Esther. So when Esther's young women, this is verse 4, and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. So she sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend to her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. And so, word gets back to Esther that her uncle is making a scene in the courtyard. Now, to give a little context here, we're 5 years removed from Esther entering the palace. Esther's had 5 years to learn how to survive and navigate all the politics of the palace. She's managed to keep her Jewish identity hidden. Things are going relatively well, I'd imagine, considering the circumstances. It started out in a terrible circumstance, but she's managed to figure out how to survive in the situation that she was put in. And all of a sudden, her uncle shows up outside the palace, creating a scene. And so Esther's first response is to send him clothes. It's to cover him up. Like, okay, like here, what? Take these clothes. And Mordecai refuses. And so once that happens, I think Esther, it clicks with Esther. She didn't even bother to ask why. What's going on? Why is my uncle creating a scene out there? And so Esther tries to respond before really understanding the situation. It's something I'm sure I'm the only person guilty of doing the same thing in situations. You see someone in distress or crying, and you try to respond or fix it rather than actually finding out what's going on. It's not a great plan to do that. If I, with my 2-year-old daughter, she's crying, throwing a fit, my response is, stop crying. Not particularly effective. And with my kid, really not effective. It just ratchets it up. But if I sit down, get eye to eye with her and try to figure out what's going on, through tears and snot and everything, eventually we get to the point of figuring out what's going on. And then we can address it. Then we can work on dealing with what's causing the grief, what's causing the suffering. So what's interesting is Esther's the queen. She's the king's husband, and she has no idea what's happening here. And so Mordecai, prepared, tells the messengers from Esther all that's happened to him, exactly how much money Haman's promising to pay, and actually sends a copy of the the decree. Just in case she wasn't sure and didn't believe it, here's what's happening. And he relays a command, which is also interesting. Mordecai still feels some sort of level of authority over his niece, which also feels backwards because she's the queen. It feels weird for her to be getting commands, but I think this helps us get an idea a little bit. Esther's unaware of what's happening. She is taking commands from her uncle. Her role is not powerful overtly in the kingdom. She doesn't have power. She doesn't have sway or influence or anything like that. And so this scene kind of sets that idea that Esther may be queen, and when we think of queen, we think like Queen of England who like runs everything. Esther is not in that position. She has no power. She has no sway. And so maybe for us when we read that idea from Mordecai, we think, oh, that's a good plan. Have his wife talk to him. That makes sense. But Esther wasn't immediately persuaded. So when the messenger comes back, went and told Esther what Mordecai had said, then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there's but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come to the king these 30 days. So here's a good reminder of that kind of cultural gap we're in right now. We're like, yeah, wife, talk to husband, talk him out of it. That seems like a good plan. And Esther's like, Mordecai, do you know where we're at? Do you know what's going on here? She says, everyone, not just me, everyone, anyone shows up unannounced at the inner court of the king, it's just death, instant death. And we say instant death, we really mean instant death. I mean, imagine being King Xerxes, you're controlling this huge area of Persia. You've already had one plot that Mordecai's uncovered for you. People are gunning for you because if they take you out, they get to be king. And so the response is to have really high security, really tight security, really instant security. And the only way that you could be preserved as you walk into that is what Esther talks about, this idea of this golden scepter. That unless the king basically instantly identifies you and kind of gives you the nod, his guards are going to cut you down. And so Esther knows all that and says that to Mordecai and then says, and on top of that, I haven't seen him for 30 days. So things don't seem to be going well there. That one I don't think is a cultural stretch. If the husband hasn't wanted to talk to the wife or be around the wife in 30 days, there's a problem. Fair? Yeah? Okay. So Esther knows how to navigate and manage and survive in this royal court, and she kind of responds back to Mordecai like, don't you understand the situation I'm in? Don't you get the problem I have? And I don't think Mordecai is necessarily naive of those situations. Mordecai has been in the kingdom. He seems to have been in somewhat proximity to the palace. But Mordecai, I think, feels the despair a little more acutely than Esther does. Esther's been unaware of this. She's living in the palace. She's learned how to navigate. Mordecai is outside watching all of his countrymen mourn as they basically watch the clock count down to their eradication. And so Esther provides herself an excuse to preserve her own life, which I think is, okay, she's like, I'm going to die if I do this. So she provides an excuse, says, all I'm going to do is get myself killed, and I'm not going to make anything change. Nothing changes if I go and do this. And she's basing this, keep in mind, off of what Mordecai told her to do, to remain kind of invisible, to not identify herself Jewish. So I can imagine in her mind a little bit too of like, you told me 5 years ago to keep this all quiet, and I've dealt with 5 years of being in this temple, being taken in by the king, being made queen, and having to live in this environment, not being able to be true to who I am, and now you're going to tell me that I need to be true to who I am so I can get my head cut off? You see the frustration maybe that's coming there a little bit? Trying to get you guys to understand, yes, no? Got it. Okay, good. Kids, you can respond. If adults won't, you can say yes or no. It's fine. We're not in school. You can respond. So from her point of view and experience, kind of steeped in this palace life, she sees only one result from Mordecai's plan. It's her being killed sooner. I think today, I mean, we can find similar excuses. We may not be facing the same dire consequences that Esther's facing, but I don't think you have to stretch to think about a biblical position that now that if you decided to make that very public and loud, that you would find some opposition in our culture. Take your pick. And regardless of what political tribe you want to look at or point at, I mean, Christians who are trying to live biblically faithfully are gonna make everyone angry who isn't Christian in one way or another. So we do find, I think, I've been guilty of finding excuses and reasons to be quiet, to stay silent, or to maybe do a half step, be an Instagram activist, but not actually do anything. Post a story so it disappears after 24 hours. I said something, but it goes away and you can remain anonymous. You hope no one screenshot it, they don't have the receipts. So Esther essentially says, there's nothing I can do to help the situation, and the only action I can take is gonna make it worse for me. And so this eunuch goes back to Mordecai. And they told Mordecai, this is verse 12, what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. So, commentators, and we've kind of talked about this a little bit, say it's very noticeable, the fact in Esther, that we don't see God directly mentioned. There's also points where it's very noticeable that it seems like God's being alluded to. I think this passage is probably the highest point of both those things. It's really noticeable that when Mordecai says that there'll be some sort of deliverance that comes from somewhere from the Jews, I think for all of us reading our Bibles, you would think he would add in there, like, from Yahweh, from God. But it doesn't. The author doesn't say it there. But he also seems to be appealing to this very strong confidence that the Jewish people would be preserved, which means that he's holding in his mind and in his heart the covenants that God's made. He's thinking back about the covenant of Abraham, where God promised through Abraham to make a great nation, and that through that nation it would bless all other nations. So there's a confidence there of somehow the Jewish people will survive. The author mentions fasting, but not prayer, when the Jewish people lament their fate. And so we see this undertone of there's a confidence somehow in Mordecai that something's going to work out. He's trying to hopefully let Esther see that maybe she's the method by which God's going to make these things work out. And so Mordecai, sure of the deliverance of the Jewish people, reminds Esther that even as the queen, she's not going to be exempt from this edict. You might say, well, she hasn't told anyone she's Jewish. Fair. But he seems pretty sure that even if she chose this passivity, that somehow she would be uncovered and face death. That somehow her choice to not act on behalf of God's people, there would be consequences from that. So he seems to be sure that God would show some sort of action as far as her disobedience in this point as well. And so this seems to work. Mordecai sends this message back. It says, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And so Esther, having heard this hard truth and a strong exhortation to action, resolves to kind of reject a passive path and to act on behalf of her people at the risk of losing everything that she's kind of worked to gain in the past 5 years. It's a big risk. It's a big jump. I want to really stick into this, that Esther was essentially kidnapped by the king, made the queen in a country that worships a different god than hers, forced to become a queen, and now has lived there 5 years and has figured out how to navigate all this. She's figured things out. She has a lot to lose now after dealing with a lot of sacrifice on her own. And now she's being asked to give up her own safety for the people that she's been hiding from to begin with. But she also seems to identify with those people. She seems to realize she can't continue to be anonymous, that she needs to identify with the people of God. And even in doing that, she actually goes, she calls back to Mordecai and tells Mordecai to have all the Jews in Susa to hold a fast, and that she's going to join in this fast, her and her household within the palace. They're going to join in this fast. Esther decides her first action here is to actually identify with the people of God. So she fasts on, she asks all the people to fast on her behalf, and she knows she needs to be reminded of where true salvation can be found. Again, it doesn't explicitly mention prayer here, but we can read between the lines that they're fasting, they're mourning, they're showing a confidence in God. And she needs to know that the people of God are with her as she prepares to make a mediation for them. And so here we can see Esther, this character in this book, this person that lived. We see a kind of an early echo. The theological term is a type. She's a type of Christ. She's a foreshadowing of Jesus a little bit here. And she does it, I think, in two ways. She does it by identifying with God's people, and then she does it with being willing to sacrifice. And so you fast forward, Jesus, fully God, with all the rights, with all the comforts, with all the responsibilities of being in the kingdom of heaven, chooses to identify with his creation, with his people, by becoming fully human. We see Jesus would give up the comfort of heaven to face the wrath of God and die on our behalf. The difference is that Jesus was completely blameless and took the punishment we deserve. When Jesus came and stepped forward and identified with his people and agreed to be the mediator for his people, he knew it required him to perish. We see towards the end of the passage there that Esther doesn't know. If I perish, I perish. She seems to be trusting that God may save her, but if he doesn't happen. Jesus knew fully well perishing was required from him. So he took on the punishment by identifying with his people who were hopelessly lost in sin. And then, when he rose again, he took place as the only one actually worthy to mediate on our behalf. Jesus doesn't have the same relationship with the Father that Esther had with Xerxes. Jesus is in perfect relationship with the Father. So Jesus can mediate on our behalf. He doesn't have to be fearful of what God the Father is going to do. He can confidently go before us and mediate on our behalf, even when we have no argument for why we shouldn't face wrath. And so, if you haven't joined into the family of faith, if you haven't put your faith in Jesus as the only true mediator for your sin, I encourage you to pray about that, consider that. If you have questions about that, talk with me, talk with one of the pastors here on staff. For the rest of us who are believers, who are Christians, what do we do today? It's October in Phoenix of 2021. What do we take away from this story about a queen in a pagan empire who's asked to make a stand for God, facing an impossible choice? How do we find an application for that? So we can pull some different applications out of it throughout the story. I've pointed out a few of them. The idea of the far-reaching consequences of our actions, the need to not remain comfortably anonymous in our culture, the need to encourage our fellow believers. But really, what I want you to consider today, what I want you to think about, is that line. It's a famous line. Many of you probably kind of perked up your ears when I read it. And it's this, and who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. I want you to consider the fact that God, who we believe is sovereign and in control of all things, in his providence,
has caused for you to be alive in Phoenix in October 2021? What is he calling you to do? What are you here for? It's a question our society and our culture wrestles with all the time. What's the point? What's the purpose of it? Kids in the room, there's going to be times where you have really hard decisions to make, where doing the right thing doesn't feel comfortable. In those times, you need to ask, is this what God's called me to do? God has put you in that position, in that classroom that you're in, with those friends that you're with, to be an example of Jesus to those people, to do the righteous thing. Parents, God has put you as the parent of your kids for such a time as this. They've put you in the job you hate for such a time as this. They've put you in the marriage that you're not sure you're supposed to be a part of for such a time as this. What has God placed you here for? What is your purpose? It's a question I think we need to dig deeper on as Christians. I know some of you who are theology nerds have probably already answered in your own head that, well, my purpose is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Yes. Yes. How do you do that now? What hard decision do you need to make? Where do you need to not be anonymous anymore? We can look to stories like Esther. Spoiler alert, it works out. We can trust that God will sustain us and perfect us. But even if he doesn't, our obedience to God is more important than our own comfort, our own wealth, our own security. I'll end with this story. On a Tuesday evening in 1925, Gladys Alward and had her soul stirred for the sake of missions by a young man she heard preach in England. She became burdened for China and knew somebody needed to go there and declare the gospel of Christ. Gladys decided to contact every important person she knew and ask them to consider going to China on a mission. She approached doctors, clergymen, bank managers. She wrote to the wealthy and influential people who she knew slightly or whom she had met in the course of her work. And they all turned her down. Gladys next approached her brother, still burdened for China. And he wasn't particularly burdened in the same way. He wasn't burdened to see the lost come to Christ. But God did have him in that position for a specific reason. Because her brother Lawrence said to her, "If you're so keen, why don't you go yourself?" And so after trying to convince every man she knew of the great need for missionaries in China, but seeing none of them respond to the call, Gladys finally realized that the somebody God wanted to use was her. And so she prayed, and I love this prayer. "Oh God, here is my Bible, here is my money, here am I. Please use us. God, please use us." After that, she made two resolutions. Her first was never again would she ask someone else to do a job that God was asking her to do. And secondly, if God would show her the way, she would go to China, even if it meant being unsupported. Gladys kept both resolutions, and God used her in amazing ways to advance the gospel in China. What do you see in your life and think someone should do something about that? Again, God has put you in a place, in a time, for a specific reason. What if that somebody that should do something is you? Don't let your comfort, don't let your wealth, or your fear of man keep you from being obedient to God. Gladys was in the 1920s. You don't run off as a single woman to China to be a missionary at that time. It's not cultural norms. She went to everyone who was supposed to go, everyone who should have done it. None of them did. So she finally decided that her burden that God gave her and her trust in God was bigger than her fear of the unknown, her fear of man. So she gave up the comfort, the wealth. Ultimately, she gave up having a husband, she never was married, so that she could go to China to reach the lost, to tell people about Jesus in China. So again, I ask the question, what has God placed you here for? And what is your purpose? This doesn't need to be a mystical thing. You don't need to like wait and pray for days until you like hear a voice from God. Look around. God is sovereign. He's put you in the place you're in. He's put you in the workplace you're in. He's put you in the school you're in. He's put you in this church. What do you see? And you look around and go, man, someone should do something about that. Well, maybe the reason that you're seeing that needs to happen is because God is actually asking you to be the one that does it. This is a scary thing. It's a scary thing for me to say. And this is coming from someone who has chosen often to stay silent, where it's been easier to not talk about Jesus, where it's been easier to say, well, someone needs to do something about this. Oh, well, those people can speak out about injustice. I'm glad someone does it. It's not me, though. I hope, as I become more like Jesus, that I become more willing to do that. That's my hope for you guys, too, is that you're willing to see what God's calling you to do. Recognize that God has put you there for a reason and to act. Not so that whatever God wants to be done will be done. God's will is going to happen. That's what Mordecai says. Jews are going to be rescued from somewhere. But what if it's you? What if you're supposed to be a part of it? What if you're supposed to be able to be a part of what God's doing, what his will is? That seems like a pretty cool job. What's your job? Oh, I got to be used by God to bless people. Let's pray. Father, this story's hard for me. I think a lot of the times that I have chosen to be passive and to be quiet, when I knew full well you'd put me there to speak up, to be your ambassador in those moments. God, I saw things through the eyes of Esther. I was comfortable, and I had figured out how to navigate without causing a stir. And I failed to see the desperation of people who were in rebellion from you, who were lost. Instead, I saw my own comfort, and I stayed quiet. God, help us to remember that you have sovereignly placed us here for a reason. We're not just here floating through life. We're not here just because this happened to be when it happened. God, you are sovereign over every detail of creation, and that means that you knew that we would be here this morning. God, you knew everything that would happen today. You knew all the frustrations and stress that all of us would come into this building with, all the distractions we would have had. You put us here so that we, as Roosevelt, could do your will, and that each of us individually could do your will. God, help us to do that. Help us to trust that regardless of what the results will be personally for us, that we desire to do your will. In Jesus' name, amen.